Throughout the world, multinational firms, private investors, and state corporations are buying agricultural land. Fred Magdoff is the author of the recent article, 21st Century Land Grabs, Accumulation by Agricultural Dispossession, which was published in the November 2013 issue of Monthly Review. Fred Magdoff is Professor Emeritus of Plant and Soil Science at the University of Vermont, and he joins me now by phone from his home in Burlington. Welcome, Fred.
Hi.
So in the article, you state that the commodification of land is essential for capital development, and you provide examples of land dispossession from the last 300 or so years. Are the current 21st century land grabs different than what was happening in the 20th century and earlier?
Well, I think usually they were geographically confined in relatively, you know, in events like in Britain with the enclosures in the 18th century and into the 19th century. Or in the United States, the taking land away from the American Indians, or, you know, in different parts of the world, it sort of happened at different times. Well, I think what we're seeing now is it's happening not everywhere, but in a good portion of the world, especially Africa, Southeast Asia, and parts of Latin America. This is going on simultaneously, and a whole... It's also happening in China, of course, which is a huge issue as well. So I think a part of it is the geographic extent, and we have a combination of trends, shall we say, that makes this more severe and more rapid. More land being dispossessed, more people being dispossessed of their land, and it's happening more quickly than it's happened in the past.
I know in past centuries, a lot of the people who lost their land, especially in Europe, would come to Canada and the United States. And as you mentioned in the article, there was displacement of the indigenous population here. But for people that lost the land, there was, you know, other land and also industrial development that was looking for labor. What's happening now to people that are losing their land? Where are they going?
Well, I think this is one of the big problems that we're facing. I think it's a global issue that you have people who are being dispossessed, who are moving off the land, being forced off their lands, and there really aren't the opportunities to migrate in the numbers or percentages as the migrations happened in the past. And also, there aren't the jobs. I mean, that's part of the reason in their own countries, or even if they are able to get to other countries in Europe, let's say there are Africans trying to get into Southern Europe and then trying to get to Northern Europe that way. And of course, Latin Americans, trying to get into the United States, but some of that has calmed down because of the job problems that are both in the United States and in Europe. So that I think, you know, this is the real issue is that there's nothing else for them to do. So what they do is, in general, I'm talking about now, obviously there are exceptions to this, in general they move into the city slums and they join what's called the informal economy, just trying to get by hook or by crook. And it could be collecting materials, or it could be doing all sorts of different things like that, or, you know, selling individual cigarettes or whatever it is. But it's not a very existence, to say the least, and they don't have the income that they really need to buy food that they could have grown if they still had their own land. So this is the issue, is that first off, there's nobody else where you can go to take away their land, which was one of the solutions, which was not a, I'm not talking in any ethical sense, just the reality of it. That isn't happening and can't happen, and the jobs aren't there in industry or in service sectors to absorb the literally hundreds of millions of people we're talking about. There's some close to a billion people in the world that make, you know, that are engaged in agriculture. And there just aren't the jobs for hundreds of millions of people. And they're being dispossessed now in the millions and tens of millions. Yeah.
Has anything, I'm just wondering about the drive to buy land, and has anything changed to make farmland a more profitable investment for people who don't necessarily want to farm it, but for global capital?
Well, a lot of the land in Africa, and especially, and I'm not sure about Indonesia and Malaysia, that a lot of that land is being rented on long-term agreements. So it's not necessarily being purchased, but they may be 70-year agreements or maybe 90-year agreements. You know, so it's almost like buying it, but it really isn't in many cases. Where you've seen the real going into the purchase of land has been South America, Brazil, and Argentina, and also private capital in the United States. I don't know if it's happened in Canada, investing in the United States. No, it's trying to... You know, when the stock market went to hell after the Great Recession, during the Great Recession, there were people who said, "Well, I want to put my money in tangible things," and one of the tangible things you can put your money is land. So there was a significant amount of private investment in land in the Midwest of the United States, some really good farmland, and they felt they could do pretty well just by renting it and waiting to see if the price went up. And meanwhile, they were getting income, just like, you know, interest that they might get if they had some bond or whatever. So that that became a fashionable investment opportunity in a real thing, as opposed to these fictitious financial instruments or financial products, as they call them, that they were selling people. That were just made up gambles. Basically, they were betting. It was a giant casino.
And I know, in terms of Canada, there have been concerns about foreign investors or investment groups buying very good farmland. I think, especially on the Canadian prairies and in Saskatchewan in particular. And for people who are listening that are interested, I know Briar Patch magazine had a quite a good article on foreign investment buying farmland in Saskatchewan. I wanted to talk about the data that you provided from a group called the Land Matrix, and you had in the article you have a top 10 of which countries are buying land and where they're buying the land from. And very interesting, Malaysia and South Sudan are both in the top 10 land buyers and land sellers. And South Sudan really struck me as a newly independent state, which had a lot of conflict, some of which is ongoing, and a very underdeveloped economy, and a lot of people who've been dispossessed by the conflict. Who's actually buying the land there? Do you know this?
Well, you have to look at this. Land Matrix has some data, but it doesn't have everything. But what you can find out is who else participated in the deal. And I did that, and I explained it in the article for one of the, I think it was from Malaysia, a particular land deal that turned out, you know, they're listed as the country of origin of the money, you know, to buy or to invest, to rent and to put the investment down to sort of get the land ready. But a lot of the capital came from Europe and came from the United States. So, I mean, they have their own private capitalists. Well, in every country in the world, you have that. But many times they may be little more than front people for investors from the wealthier countries of the world. So it's you have to go back to the particular deal, and then you have to go back and trace it back, which is possible with the internet nowadays, to find out where the other money came from. They will, in the Land Matrix database, you can search by country, and then within the country you can look at the various deals, and then I think they give secondary investors. You need to go, track it down to get the information about the particular deal. So in a way, that's misleading, to have them listed. But they're listed as they're listed. I mean, that's how it comes out in the database. But the point I was trying to make is that in the article is that that doesn't mean that all this money to buy land somewhere else came from South Sudan or came from Malaysia. It didn't. It came from somewhere else. And they, although, are listed as the country of origin.
In terms of the land in most African countries, I know you talk about this a bit in the article. What has been the ownership previously? Has it mostly been state land in the past?
No. Most hasn't been state at all. It's been sort of by customary use, without titles. So, you know, without formal titles. And so this has laid it open for exploitation, for corrupt government officials to make deals with the foreign capital basically dispossess the people and give them the land to use at a very nominal price. So one of the issues has been the lack of any formal land tenure. There was an informal land tenure, but there wasn't a formal one, and there was no formal ownership by the individuals, except with the exception when the white settler, you know, there are some colonies in Africa that were more favored as for settlers to come and to have agricultural endeavors, to build farms. Like Rhodesia, you know, it became Zimbabwe, you know, South Africa. So there are a number of countries in Africa where you have private land, significant amounts of private land. Almost all of that is currently owned by whites or was formerly owned by whites, and it was converted into private land under by the colonial powers. So they converted that customary use land into private white-owned land. When they were in charge.
I also wanted to ask you about China, where a lot of land that was previously state or communally owned is now in private hands, and a lot of people have been leaving agricultural areas to move into urban centers. Is the Chinese state planning for the population that is being dispossessed from the agricultural areas?
Well, this is, I think, the big problem. They don't seem to have a plan for that. I mean, I'm just looking at their own documents, and I quote from some of them in the article, is that their idea is that we're going to move these literally 250 million people out of rural areas into the urban areas, and that's going to be better because people in urban areas make more money than people in rural areas, and they're going to be able to consume more, and therefore they're going to be able to stimulate the economy. And the logic there is beyond me. I mean, it's putting the cart before the horse. You need to create jobs for people, and then people come to take those jobs. I mean, that's the way it normally happens. And so you have a situation where people have gotten some money for their land. Now, in China also, the land's not privately owned. And it is owned or controlled either by the state or by mostly local and regional governments and villages. You know, the communes would own it or the village owned it. And but people whose land was taken away, their houses were taken away in many cases also to bulldoze. For industrial development or for other purposes, some get compensation, some don't. And there were stories about people who actually got compensation. They were moved into the cities. They got apartments. They bought some consumer products with their money that they got for their 1.5 acres or whatever they had, or 1 acre. And then they could not use these consumer products like a flat screen TV or a washing machine for clothing because they couldn't afford the electricity because they didn't have a job. So, I mean, it's one of the more bizarre things that I came across, I would say. How it's going to play out, I have no idea. Millions of people in China, millions of farmers have been dispossessed, and they are, according to them, according to their officials, they want to move this huge number of people into the cities, and how that's going to play out, I have no idea. But it could be quite a disaster, just with people who are sitting around in cities without anything to do, and and not able to grow their own food. And I mean, there's the potential there for instability.
Your article has a quote from Marx that a rational agriculture is incompatible with the capitalist system. Can you talk about how large farms, although financially more profitable, are not necessarily any better at food production?
Well, they're not. I mean, basically, the real advantage of a large farm is that you can produce more with fewer people. So that the labor that goes into a hectare or an acre or whatever to produce a certain amount of whatever thing you're interested in, corn or wheat or rice or whatever, the amount of labor is less because you're using larger equipment and now really humongous, a huge equipment that's used. In the American Midwest, it is common to have literally thousands of acres, 2,000 or 3,000 acres to be a farm. And that's, we're talking, what does that mean, about 800 hectares or something like that. And when it used to be like 160 or 300 acres or 600 acres. And so the major advantage as far as a person who's doing this is concerned is that they need less labor and their cost of production in general goes down. But the problem is, number one, is they don't necessarily produce more per hectare. And this is a really important point, or per acre, that you can have very productive small farms. It's not an issue of production of food per unit area. It's an issue that is large farms. It's an issue of producing more food per labor hour that you put in. And so that's one of the issues. The other issue is it's not just the size of the farm. I mean, it's also that in capitalist agriculture, you're like in the Midwest of the U.S., you're in a corn and soybean system. Corn to soybeans, corn, maybe soybeans, you know. There's more corn grown than soybeans, so there's more. There's got to be a lot of farms that are growing corn after corn. And that is, it's a lousy system from an ecological point of view. It is not diverse enough. In other words, not enough crops in rotation. It pollutes the water tremendously. That's a good reason, a good part of the reason why we have so much nitrates and phosphates reaching the mouth of the Mississippi River and that so-called dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico is a result of this. The system is just not... It is not efficient from an ecological point of view, and it is not ecologically sound. And there are many other examples of that, but what they're doing is they're producing what they think with their soil and their climate is going to get them the most profit. It's not what's going to, you know, satisfy people's needs for food or satisfy or be in tune with the environment. They can't concern themselves with that if they're trying to make money in a capitalist society. It's the same thing like any business of, you know, a manufacturer. They're trying to make money, and they, you know, if something happens that's some pollution happens, something they give off from their smokestack or in their water, something that's not good for humans or others, you know, that's called an externality. It means they didn't intend it, but too bad, you know, just it happens. And if there's no regulations to force them to stop it, they don't.
I've been speaking to Fred Magdoff. He's the author of the article, 21st Century Land Grabs, Accumulation by Agricultural Dispossession. And the article is published by Monthly Review and is available at monthlyreview.org. And you're listening to Mud & Water on CKUW 95.9 FM.